Move on into the home stretch of our conference. Thank you again, everyone, for staying with us. Distance learners, we're not hearing from you. The email is open, and we're looking for your questions. I anticipate we will be able to take some questions during the panel discussion, so please get them ready for us. So real quickly, I just wanted to say, in planning this conference, we did something we don't usually do, which is we put out a call for abstracts. And we got a number of very interesting abstracts. Unfortunately, most of them pertain to the RFK case, and we were overloaded on RFK-related material. One of the abstracts that I did feel very compelled to accept was from our next speaker. And it is looking at, I'm not going to say too much, but very briefly, I think most of you are aware of what happened in South Africa following the collapse of apartheid there with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And the way in which that was able, that enabled closure for a lot of people, probably not everyone, but for a lot of people, it's a different approach to the resolution of historical problems. Our next speaker, Mark Rabinowitz, who traveled all the way here from Eugene, Oregon, is going to be talking to you about truth and reconciliation in the Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and other cases. And then we're going to have Mark stay up here. We're going to bring back both Bill and Joe and a couple other people for our panel discussion. So without further ado, Mark Rabinowitz.
Thank you. Thanks. Well, I feel extremely honored to be here, to have been included in this event, and have the highest respect to everyone who has worked so hard to expose all of these deep truths. I'm grateful to the speakers and the audience members and allies not with us today who have sought to shift the paradigms to have accountability, to persevere with courage and integrity. I feel this is part of what our country has to contribute to civilization. Thank you for your service. I heard Dr. Wecht in Dallas in 2013 at the Coalition on Political Assassinations Conference and appreciated the unequivocal clarity, saying that the removal of President Kennedy was a coup d'etat in America. That conference was co-organized by the late John Judge, who some of you knew very well. I met John while living in the D.C. area in the 1990s, and was glad that his final conference was his largest and got some long overdue attention from the media, including an almost respectful profile in the Wall Street Journal. This conference today seems to be the only one in the country this year that has the courage to point out the truth about who killed MLK and RFK, and most important, why. I'm also impressed this event is held at a university, given the reluctance that most schools have to discussing the, quote, third rail of deep politics. A friend of mine used to teach political science at the University of Oregon, which has a very liberal reputation. He told me that he privately agreed about the Kennedy assassinations, but confided that if he said this in his classes, he would be unemployable in academia, not just at that university. And he didn't get a job with tenure anyway. Last month, the MLK 50 commemoration in Memphis included Pulitzer Prize-winning author Taylor Branch. I heard him speak 3 years ago at the University of Oregon, and he was surprisingly hostile to the idea that James Earl Ray was not the lone gunman and was contemptuous of being asked politely about the King versus Jowers trial in 1999. Which was not what I was expecting to hear. Also last month, we had a MLK 50th commemoration event in Eugene, sponsored by a successor organization to Clergy and Lady Concerned About Vietnam, which organized the famous Martin Luther King April 4, 1967 speech at Riverside Church in New York, where Martin Luther King denounced the war on Vietnam. That speech has been cited as a primary motive for the assassination exactly a year later. But this modern CALC, a different organization but their successor, did not want to discuss this inconvenient history. They said another time would be better than the anniversary of the murder, which was astonishing as well. Ironically, their event had a reading of excerpts from King's second-to-last speech, Staying Awake Through a Great Revolution, where he discussed having the courage to speak truths, even if they were unpopular. At the last minute, under some pressure, they let the local NAACP president speak for a few minutes, and he included one sentence that the government was involved in killing King. And it's a delight to see this event where self-censorship is not necessary. But why this reluctance has become widespread is more interesting to me than the specific details of the crimes. The psychology seems more critical than proving more facts about the logistics of what happened to the Kennedys and King. While good research needs to continue, we don't need more details to understand the basics of what happened. I've been interested in these assassinations and deep politics in general for over three decades. I want to briefly mention some of this background to set a context for my presentation, observations about the roles and obstacles to forensic science and law regarding covert operations, and suggest ways that the truth and reconciliation approach might shift public consciousness in order to transform violent policies toward a more peaceful world. The avoidance of the obvious by the political system, by the media, educational institutions about these traumas of Kennedys and King are the most important aspects of the case for me. After 9/11, and in preparation for a protest of the seemingly inevitable war on Iraq, I created the website www.oilempire.us to connect the dots between 9/11 foreknowledge, peak oil, the attack on Iraq, media manipulation, faith-based voting machines, and other topics. I also run peakchoice.org, cooperation or collapse, about energy and ecology and how we could use the remaining resources as energy relocation for community resilience, relocalization of food production in particular. And most relevant for this event is jfkmlkrfk.com about the legacy of the 1960s as a result of the assassinations. I come from a medical family, and this has influenced my concerns about these events. My dad is a retired cardiovascular pathologist, the study of dead hearts to understand how to prevent heart disease. Dead hearts can also be a metaphor for the lack of empathy and compassion in our society. In Martin Luther King's April 4, 1967 speech, Beyond Vietnam, he said, quote, "If America's soul becomes totally poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam. It can never be saved so long as it destroys the deepest hopes of men the world over." So it's hard to say if the country is totally poisoned or merely suffering from life-threatening diseases that will require systemic cooperation to undo. I have found not focusing on that to be helpful anymore. It certainly looks hopeless. It surely is daunting. But we haven't really tried hard as a society to undo the damage. Another metaphor, if you fell into the river next to this campus, you would probably not react passively, even if you believed you were not a good swimmer. We all have a survival system that is involuntary. And faced with big emergencies, sometimes we can do things that seem impossible on a rational level. And undoing the damage of the 20th century will require tapping into these potentials on a civilizational level, something I think the Kennedys and King had come to understand. I recently came across an obscure word, pathography, which the dictionary defines as, quote, "a study of the life of an individual or the history of a community with regard to the influence of a particular disease or psychological disorder." And I think a lot of what we have been doing is pathography. When I was a teenager, I first decided to learn how the world works. I was freaked out about the Three Mile Island partial meltdown. just east of here. And from that, I graduated to understanding nuclear war preparations and wanted to know how the potential omnicide, the extermination of everything, was tolerated and how we got ourselves into this situation. I went through what I call the one-way door to uncomfortable knowledge over nuclear war concerns, and gradually realized most people don't want to think about these things, whether nuclear technology, political assassinations, or other major dysfunctions. We don't have a lot of social support networks for addressing these understandings. That in itself causes difficulty for many who do choose to focus on them. It's much more popular and accepted to ignore these things, especially in our distracted culture and surrounded by material luxuries. But I wanted to understand why efforts for peace were mostly not successful. And these are not murder mysteries, but inconvenient history that needs close examination. I am paying homage to a number of people's ideas and trying to present a new arrangement of how they fit together. Forensic science and the court of public opinion. Now, we've had a half century of documenting difficult truths about the assassinations of the Kennedys and King, with very mixed results. Most of the public is skeptical of the official claims, yet confused about which counter-narratives might be correct. And these suspicions were insufficient for the coherent social response that would be needed. There have been great accomplishments of many researchers, some here, many others not, but they did not result in the changes to prevent future abuses. A controversial concept, perhaps, here is to think the role of forensics is important to understand, but forensics by itself does not lead to social shifts. With President Kennedy, the single bullshit theory is an insult to anyone's intelligence. It doesn't keep the media from continuing to promote it. Last month, the New York Times, even in an article about the MLK anniversary, was telling its readers that James L. Ray did it, Lee Harvey Oswald did it, end of story. And with RFK, I have to admit that the idea of hypnosis being a factor in what happened with him is hard for me to accept intellectually. I'm convinced it's true, but there's part of it that challenges my beliefs about free will. But of course, we live in a society with a media system that hypnotizes us to believe and act in counterproductive ways, so maybe it's not that much of a stretch to believe that RFK was killed by someone under hypnosis. One pattern between the three crime scenes of JFK, MLK, and RFK is alteration of the crime scenes. The limo in Dallas was cleaned. Other things were covered up. There was witness intimidation and murder. With Martin Luther King, the cutting down of the bushes in the tree the next day is clearly alteration of the crime scene. The alteration of the crime scene at the hotel in Los Angeles was also evidence of a cover-up. 2 months after 9/11, I went to a lecture by Michael Rupert in Portland, Oregon, called The Truth and Lies of 9/11. And he opened his presentation with a showing of the Zapruder film, the video of John Kennedy being killed. And he said it showed clearly that Kennedy was killed from the front, and therefore Oswald did not fire the fatal shot. But he also cautioned that that fact did not change the way society was working, that the physical evidence by itself did not lead anywhere. I think part of the reason for that is we are in a state of post-constitutional government. We have the three branches of government we were taught about, the judicial, Congress, president, but none of these branches of government seem to have any meaningful oversight over the national security state. In 1967, Jim Garrison gave an interview to Playboy magazine where he said that fascism may come to America in the guise of national security. I think it already has in some ways. And the legal system in all three cases was remarkably unable to address what happened. The way Oswald was interviewed after being arrested was a violation of standard police procedures. Allowing Ruby into the police station was clearly a violation of police procedures. Having the Supreme Court Chief Justice ratify the cover-up, where do you go after that? If the head of the Supreme Court blesses it, there's nowhere else to go, at least in our legal system. In Garrison's autobiography, which was included in Oliver Stone's film, there's a sequence about a surprise witness named Charles Spiesel, who showed up during the trial and testified that he had had drinks with Clay Shaw, the accused, and Lee Harvey Oswald and others, and that they had discussed killing the president. Under cross-examination, Mr. Spiesel said that he fingerprinted his daughter before she went to school and when she came back to make sure it was the same girl. There was a round of laughter in the courtroom, and Garrison wrote in his autobiography that he saw his case fly out the window never to be seen again because he realized he'd been set up by a plant, and for the CIA to sabotage a trial was child's play for them, like shooting fish in a barrel. And he said that they were subtle and sophisticated. King, his legal process, Ray never had a trial, as I assume we all know. He couldn't get one afterward. And pleading guilty to something that he did not commit reminds me of many of the exonerees from death row or long prison terms, where they're forced to make a plea and then they regret it for decades or the rest of their life. With Robert Kennedy, a similar suppression of evidence. Garrison, in particular, cautioned that Bobby needed to go public about his concerns to protect himself, and sadly was proven correct. Congress, for many decades, has shied away from meaningful investigations of these concerns and related topics. They are supposed to have the power to appropriate money for the budget, and yet the intelligence agencies do not disclose how much money they spend. Congress has the sole power to declare war. When was the last time Congress actually declared war on another country? And very few members of Congress have spoken out about covert operations in a meaningful way, and most of them are no longer in Congress. They declined to impeach Nixon for waging war in Cambodia. The Church Committee investigated the performance of the CIA in helping with the investigation of what happened to the president, but not that they might have had a role in his removal from office. The House Select Committee on Assassinations made some efforts to investigate these crimes. They admitted there may have been a second gunman in Dallas, but oh, we're out of time, we're out of money, someone else will have to look into it. The late Gaetan Fonzi, who was an investigator, said that we know what happened, we just don't know all the details. And similar avoidance of uncomfortable truths happened with the Iran-Contra hearings, the October surprise hearings, and the 9/11 hearings. The presidency is similarly disinclined to investigate. Bruce Gagnon, one of the few peace activists who does talk about these things with the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, said that it is my belief that since the JFK assassination, the secret government, the CIA, and the military-industrial complex have been running the show. They have not allowed anyone to become president from either party that was not under their control. And Jim DiEugenio, who some of you probably are familiar with, wrote years ago that in a way, the Democratic Party never recovered from Dallas, and certainly not from Robert Kennedy's assassination. And the implication of that is that the Democratic Party is split between active complicity in these crimes, and others who are afraid to talk about these things. Like many of you, I have gone to state and federal representatives for many years to try to raise these concerns, and have found some of them privately are very aware of it, but they won't say anything in front of a microphone. So we are run by the military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower warned us about, a creature of World War II and the Manhattan Project and the OSS, and it has now metastasized out of control. Trump and his supporters promote the term deep state, a term borrowed from Turkey about two decades ago, on the interconnections between military intelligence, mafia, financial powers. But the newer use of deep state in our country glosses over how those systems have differences over how to run the show. Part of the deep state opposed Trump's selection, part was in favor. In the old Soviet Union, there was a field of study in the U.S. spy system called Kremlinology, trying to figure out how the Soviet system worked by external clues, since their system was opaque. Studying the U.S. deep state, the military-industrial complex, seems to have more transparency, but can be difficult to determine as well. So since the overt systems of accountability have not worked, what can we do instead? And the best suggestion that I've heard from others is a parallel system called Truth and Reconciliation, which was most famously applied in South Africa after the end of apartheid. The 1999 King versus Jowers trial in Memphis was explicitly based on this. They were seeking truth instead of punishment. We've tried punishment, and some people may seem to deserve it, but it does not lead to the shifts that we need. After the fall of the apartheid government and the shift to apparent democracy, President Mandela asked Desmond Tutu to be in charge of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and it was to tone down the extreme bitterness and division in their society after sort of a civil war had been underway for many years. The commission gave amnesty to politically motivated crimes if the perpetrators were willing to tell all in public. And it wasn't only on the white side. There were atrocities committed by many groups. It was an imperfect system. There were some relatives of victims who were dead set against it, most notably the family of Steve Biko, who was assassinated by a police unit. They wanted their loved ones' killers to be locked up and imprisoned, which did not happen. There was also no apologies offered by the perpetrators, which some of the victims found difficult to accept. And perhaps the biggest problem were there were no reparations. So people were told, okay, these atrocities happened, these murders and tortures and so forth, but there was extreme economic injustice in apartheid South Africa, which was not addressed in detail by the post-apartheid regime. There was no promise of 40 acres and a mule. Not that that happened here either. One difference also between South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the potential for it here is it happened after a change in government. The white minority felt extreme pressure from the black majority, and a truth and reconciliation process for the United States is unlikely to happen after a change in government here. How could we have it happen as a non-governmental process in our country? But despite the benefits and problems of this, it's been adopted as a model all over the world. If countries in Latin America, in the Arab world, in Tunisia, they're doing this right now, in other places, there have been efforts, Each of them have their own story, some better than others. Canada had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission recently about Native reservations and Native schools where children were forcibly taken from their families. There was one in Greensboro, North Carolina, about a Ku Klux Klan murder of labor activists, which had police complicity. Last year I heard a Holocaust survivor named Ava Kaur speak, and she survived Auschwitz as a twin and was spared to have medical experiments performed on her and her twin sister. And after many years of being bitter about her experience of evil, she got to the point of forgiving the Nazis. Not to forget what was done, not to endorse what was done, but to let go of the bitterness that she felt about that because she was getting older and didn't want to carry that burden around the rest of her life. I recommend a book called Radical Forgiveness, which talks about the sort of emotional liberation, and it applies to these concerns as well. Some in the control system in our society might wish to shift away from these patterns of domination, but might be fearful of the public reaction. How can we encourage whistleblowers? How can we encourage some in the deep state to go, okay, we're all living on the same planet. If we keep the war system going, we will no longer have a planet that's as habitable. It's not about punishing them. It's about shifting while we still have some resources to be able to have a better world. In Martin Luther King's Vietnam speech in 1967, he said we need reparations for the people of Vietnam, including medical care in the United States if it was necessary. We need reparations from the national security state here, but that involves shifting away from trillion-dollar war budgets and more nuclear weapons and war all over the world to using these resources in ways that serve the interests of our great-great-grandchildren. You've had tiny admissions, such as President Obama admitting that the U.S. helped overthrow the government in Iran in 1953, but pretty much everybody in the Middle East already knew that. Perhaps it's more like Alcohol Anonymous. We need a detox from empire, admitting the problem and changing the behavior. Last month, there was a new museum that opened in Montgomery, Alabama, about the history of lynching in the United States. And the organizer of the museum, the attorney Brian Stevenson, explicitly talked about how he hoped that the memorial and museum was a step towards truth and reconciliation on the model of South Africa. In the King versus Jowers trial in 1999, Andrew Young said that, quote, we have always had a no-fault analysis on this. We were not trying to punish anybody. We were approaching this more like they approached it in South Africa, that in order to have a real reconciliation, you have to know the truth. And later on in the transcript was a conversation that he had had with Lloyd Jowers, where Lord Jowers said that, I think the only way we're ever going to be able to prove this conspiracy is to get the FBI and CIA's records on it. It is common knowledge, white and black both know, that J. Edgar Hoover hated Dr. King with a personal passion. Andrew Young. But there wouldn't be any record of it. Lord Jowers, you don't think they would make records on something like that? Andrew Young, no. Lord Jowers, well, you're probably right. It wouldn't be too smart to, would it? How would you prove it? Andrew Young, well, it is very difficult to prove. That's the reason why we advocated what they did in South Africa, declare general amnesty and let everyone come forward and clear their conscience. I'm not convinced that that would work with the assassinations of the 60s or other deep crimes, but we haven't really tried it either. So Unfortunately, setting up a process like this would need to be non-governmental, at least in the foreseeable future. There's some advantages to that. There's some disadvantages to that. A non-governmental approach is easier to establish. It's less controlled and censored. But it's also easier to manipulate with false claims. John Judge said toward the end of his life, "Just because someone said the government is lying does not mean they're telling the truth." And the binary view that there's the official story and then the counter-narrative omits several intermediate stages. We have the limited hangouts, a term from the Nixon administration, which is a fallback to the official story. It looks like a disclosure, but it serves to shut down further inquiry. It's like using Newton's laws to describe how the universe works at a subatomic level. It's useful for building a bridge, but is incomplete. So calling the JFK assassination an intelligence failure or the mafia did it, there might be pieces of truth in that, but it is clearly not the full story. You also have the problem of the political left, which I used to consider myself part of. Not anymore, for a number of reasons. The political left has been remarkably uninterested in talking about these topics. So you have the media willing to say that Martin Luther King spoke out against the war on Vietnam on April 4, 1967, but not that this got him killed on April 4, 1968. Democracy Now, for example, they did mention the verdict right after the 1999 trial, and then they've forgotten about it for almost 20 years. This year on April 4, they had an interview with Reverend James Lawson, who sneaked in at the end of his interview a minute about this, and the show host asked, "Well, what do you mean James L. Ray didn't do it?" So he said, and then he went, then they went, "Oh, well, we're out of time. Thanks for being on the show." And maybe they really were out of time, but they can certainly do a follow-up if they want. I'm a big fan of the word maybe when dealing with these sorts of difficult investigations, because best evidence is sometimes subjected to conflicting interpretations, incomplete data. In school, I learned about something called Piltdown Man, one of my favorite examples of forensics. In the early days of paleontology, there were people in Britain who were upset that the earliest people were not British. So they made up a fake skull and buried it and then discovered it. And for four decades, this was considered real, that, oh yes, the oldest people were British. And of course, it was a complete hoax. And now it's a ridicule and laughingstock. In the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation, Gayton Fonzie talked about how he was fed disinformation by Claire Booth Luce from Time Life Publications in order to send him on a wild goose chase so he would use up his time and his travel budget. And he found that as significant evidence of conspiracy as the actual forensics of the case. On the way here 2 days ago, I stopped at the Flight 93 Memorial, where Flight 93 crashed. I'm persuaded by the alternative narrative that it was shot down to protect the Capitol, but maybe that's true and maybe that's not true. It was amused some years after the attacks that there was a claim that there was no plane crash whatsoever, that the whole thing was just faked and it was all sleight of hand. But that came from a publication that also says that the Holocaust didn't happen and Adolf Hitler deserved the Nobel Peace Prize. So that can be safely ignored. Last year, in North Carolina, there was a well-funded conference called the First Annual Flat Earth International Conference. Looked like a serious effort. The media came to cover it. They covered it more than this event. But it's hard to imagine that that event was not just to attract incredulous coverage. A straw man. So if you don't believe that Lee Harvey Oswald shot JFK, then you also must believe the earth is flat and the Holocaust didn't happen and all the rest. Rule by ridicule. There are conspiracies to deny that there are conspiracies. There are also conspiracies to create false conspiracies to discredit inquiry. Some claims are true, some are not. Some are like a fighter plane that's being attacked by a heat-seeking missile, and it will throw flares out the back of the plane to distract the missile, and then the missile gets confused and doesn't shoot down the plane. And some of the false claims of conspiracy serve a similar purpose. And making the whole topic seem like an exercise in crazy making deters most of our fellow citizens into treating them with the sober attention that they deserve. I've also run into people who, contemplating this disconnect, end up with various forms of mental stress and mental illness. It's an occupational hazard. My mom is a psychiatrist focused on healing individual dysfunctions, but there's not much attention in the mental health profession about what happens to societies that begin to unravel. What was the psychological impact of having the Kennedys and King killed and other abuses? How can we have the truth and reconciliation without radical forgiveness, without better anger management in our society? If we were healthier as a society, would we have Donald Trump as our president? Probably not. So, one aspect of the Kennedy and King situation is the intimidation of the families. Privately, we know that Robert Kennedy understood what happened to his brother, at least in the basics, that Jackie Kennedy had even sent an envoy to Moscow to tell Khrushchev that they understood the communists had nothing to do with it. It was a right-wing coup in America. And yet, in public, until recently, they have endorsed the official story. Senator Kennedy, at the end of his life, wrote a book called, Senator Ted Kennedy, wrote a book called True Compass, in which he endorsed the Warren Commission, when privately he knew it was not true. Now Robert Kennedy Jr. has broken the silence and is talking a little bit about this, but the amount of pressure they must be under, I can only imagine. I personally know in my community of a county commissioner, a pretty low-level political person, who was given death threats if he was going to run for re-election and chose not to. So if that happens at a local level, I can only imagine what happens to the Kennedy family. And the King family, after the Jowers verdict, said that they'd done their service and now it was up to the rest of the society to amplify and spread this information. I recently met an NAACP activist who is somewhat elderly. She was active in the 50s in civil rights. She even told me that she heard Senator John Kennedy speak while sitting in the congressional balcony as a young woman. But she'd never heard of the Jowers trial. She'd been involved in civil rights more than almost 60 years, and she'd never heard of this, and was astonished to hear about it. She wanted to know more about it, but then she also asked me, well, how do you deal with knowing this, because it's so disturbing? And I said, well, that's a good question. It's something we need to discuss. You need to have a lot of inner resilience. You need to have supportive networks around you, and you need to accept that your understanding of this may not accomplish what should be accomplished. That's not an endorsement of it, but that's the society we live in. What do we do with that understanding? How do we amplify it in a way that people can hear it? I've long thought that the denial and avoidance of these topics is a clue about what happened. If it was the mafia that killed President Kennedy, would we still be so afraid of talking about this? If it was a lone racist who maybe had some help from the Klan who killed Martin Luther King, would there be such aversion to the evidence? If it was just a crazed person who killed Senator Robert Kennedy, would we have such aversion to this? No. And part of the deep secret of this is that the powers that be that orchestrated these crimes, they probably understood in advance that they would get away with it due to the fear and reluctance of most people to think about these topics. They would not have dared if they thought the media would have exposed it, if Congress would have held hearings, if there would have been massive public objection. And that acquiescence is at the heart of what needs to be shifted. By the time the realization started to trickle out, the coup was in place, the Vietnam War was escalated, and the power of the three-letter agencies was complete. Truth and reconciliation isn't only for the covert intelligence agencies and international conflicts. It applies at all levels, within neighborhoods, within a family, and most important, within ourselves. And for people to be able to admit that we live in a society where the CIA can kill the president and civil rights leaders and candidates without any accountability, that requires admitting that we have allowed this to happen in our name. I've run into many veterans of the anti-Vietnam War effort, for example, where you raise the issue of what happened to the Kennedys and King, and they react with hostility, which at first surprised me, but then I realized they would have to admit their own silence about these topics when it mattered. The writer James Douglas, author of JFK and the Unspeakable, which many people consider the best introduction on these topics, he admitted in his writings that for many years as a peace activist, he did not understand the significance of Kennedy's removal from office. Since then, he's more than made up for it. He was the only writer to attend the entire King versus Jowers trial. And the book is really the best introduction to these topics. But most famous academics, activists, etc., bank on their credibility. And if they have to admit making a mistake, that they overlooked something, that can be threatening to their status. So, my final medical influence is my brother, who's a medical doctor in pediatrics. And part of what the stress we're dealing with in our 21st century now is recognizing that the continuation of life on this planet is at risk, not just the current generation, but the disruption to the process. I was 2 months old when President Kennedy was removed from office. I have no conscious memory of it. But the day before I was born, Kennedy went to the UN and called off the Cold War, the arms race, and the moon race. And I'm curious, how many people here are familiar with President Kennedy's September 20, 1963 speech to the UN? Some. I've never run into anybody outside the JFK research world or a few people in the space industry who have ever heard about this. Kennedy said to the UN, let's go to the moon as a joint effort with the Soviet Union. Can you imagine the transformation of consciousness, having an American and a Russian holding hands in front of an Earth flag on the moon? And why is this totally absent from the historical record? If you go to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in Washington, there's no mention of it. The curators are well aware of it, but when you ask them, well, why don't you mention this, they develop convenient amnesia. And for me, this is my main motive for being interested in deep politics, not to study the trajectories of the bullets fired in the different crimes. That's important, but secondary. It's that if we're going to shift the resources spent on the military-industrial complex for collective cooperation and survival, we're going to have to defang the covert intelligence operations of the governments, and not just in this country as well. And we know how to kill people. We're very good at that. But do we know how to cooperate? Do we know how to convert the Marines so that they can plant trees all over the world, and the U.S. Navy to work on preventable disease? 6 weeks of military spending would give clean water to almost everybody in the world. That would provide more actual security than more bombs. And we all know this as a society, and yet how many politicians even come close to hinting at that? Very few. So, the biggest secret, as far as we know, is the nuclear war plan. But we know essentially what it is. And it's past the time to shift, because there's a difference between things being secret and things being kept from us. So the information presented at this conference and similar efforts, none of it is secret, it's just obscure and not known. And the things that are super secret, we basically know what they are. So I guess my suggestion and what I'm working on is figuring ways to make these big topics more digestible for our fellow citizens, regardless of political perspective and flavors. How can we make it easier for people to accept that this is our actual history and what we can do with this understanding in order to shift towards the peaceful world that we need? That parallel universe where Kennedy was reelected, Martin Luther King became an elder statesman, and Bobby was part of the second term. What would the world have been if the Cold War had ended in the second term? If the war in Vietnam ended in 1964-65? What society would we live in today if we had chosen global cooperation instead of endless warfare? What lessons can we learn from our collective silence? How can we make this relevant for the younger generations? You have the March for Our Lives, Me Too, Black Lives Matter, climate movements, and others suggest that there's a groundswell of youth who are upset about their mismanaged future, but most of them do not have much technical background in understanding how we got to where we are. Covert operations like the Kennedy and King assassinations are not part of the worldviews. They're certainly not taught in colleges and high schools. How can we, who have studied these in great detail, reach out to high school students and college students? Can truth and reconciliation bypass some of the reluctance and the ridicule surrounding these topics? Can it reduce the fear of elites to engage in historical truth-telling? How can we live together on spaceship Earth? So, thank you for your attention and your concern and vision.